My mind runs back through all the ways Bilal and Azima used them aboard the ship. Nets and shields and canvas, but weapons too. Bilal's favorite was the pulse cannon. Thinking about the bright streaks it used to launch across the waterway, I get another idea. My uncle always kept a flare gun inside his boat, just in case. We never had to use it, but I've held it in my hands before, felt the weight of it. If I could get my hands on the console, maybe I could manipulate the station into something like it. Send up a flare and jump overboard. But Jericho has made sure I'm safely out of reach of both consoles. I glance left and right. On one side, moonlight paints the riverway as bright as snow. On the other is an empty plain that looks just like everything else in Grim Garden. I shift my weight to one side and keep watching Jericho. She's focused now, increasing our speed, sliding us down a new stretch of river. She's not watching as I dig my right heel down, searching. Old habits never die. It came in handy when Isadora and Rothi attacked, and now it might be the only thing that can save me. I finally feel it between my heel and boot. It's the size and shape of a coin. Small, but it's always been there, waiting for a moment like this. I just have to keep her talking, distracted. They're chasing us. Jericho makes a thoughtful noise.
I doubt it's any friend of yours.
I answer without hesitation. That's my family back there. The second you took me, you guaranteed they'd be coming for you.
Family.
Jericho chews on the word.
You could be right. More likely, though, it's a member of my family. And we're not above murdering one another for the right price. Others will want you for themselves. As I said, the Genesis are valuable.
I shift my weight again and let my eyes drag over the river. I crane my neck, hoping to draw Jericho's attention away from the work of my boots. I can feel the piece of Nyxia moving now. It's not easy work, but I manage to get it to the inside of my ankle. I can't remember when I replaced the piece I used against Rothi and Isadora, but I know why. Because there's always a threat. A sliver of Nyxia for desperate times. The rhythmic ping doesn't sound. The other ship is falling behind.
Try and keep up with me now,
Jericho whispers. She pulls up a map of the riverways, examining it, plotting a new course. It's the distracted moment I've been waiting for. I have seconds at the most. Quietly, I jam my left heel into my right, pinching the boot down. I slide my left foot up as far as I can. It's hard with the ropes tight over my ankles. A second later, though, it slips the heel. The boot tips over the wrong way. I glance up in panic, but she's still tracing a route across the map. Carefully, I tilt the boot back with my foot. There's a frightening second of nothing. Then, the Nyxian coin tumbles out, bouncing twice and spinning to a stop. I shift my body and snatch it up with bound hands. It's a life jacket in the hands of a drowning man. Jericho starts to say something as I focus on my first manipulation. I'm amazed when it takes. The black coin expands, and the only image I can summon comes from those regular nights with Pops down at Snookers. I center the image of a pool cue in my mind. It stretches the substance until the opposite end smacks against the Nyxian console. As soon as it makes contact, I feel the bigger connection pulse to life. All that Nyxia. All that power, all at my fingertips. Jericho whips around, curses flying, but I'm too fast. My second manipulation flings itself through the link. Flare gun, flare gun, flare gun. The manipulation shivers from my brain, through the link, into the console. A familiar red-handled barrel takes form. Another thought points the thing skyward and pulls the trigger. She lunges, but the shot is an explosion of sound and color. It cuts a path through the sky before bursting out, bright enough for anyone following us to see. Jericho hesitates for just a second. I take the extended Nyxia in both hands and pull myself to my feet. She starts forward again, but another tug brings the pool cue swinging around like a spear. Jericho dodges back, calling her own Nixie into its weapon form. She slips into a fighting stance before realizing she's got it all wrong. I'm not looking for a fight. I take a deep breath and leap. The stars spin overhead. My hands almost fumble the Nixia. My entire body braces for impact as the water backhands the air from my lungs. The force of it crushes the entire left side of my body. I almost drown as my mouth opens in forced exhale. Dark, cold, dark, cold. I wonder if I'm about to die. But an anthem beats inside my chest. The same one that saved me from Isadora and Rothy. A bone-deep promise I make to myself every morning. Today is not the day that I die. I come gasping out of the water. Overhead, the flare is falling. The boat's momentum took it about 500 meters down the river. I watch as it starts to wheel. The Nixia pulses in my left hand, feeding off my urgency. I concentrate on the image of Pops' army knife. I hold it there, front and center, before forcing the vision into the waiting substance. It shifts instantly, and the weight of his knife fills my palm. I lean my body so that I'm floating on my back and start slashing through the ropes. The first few coils slip from my wrists. Jericho's turned the boat around. It thunders, picking up speed again. I slip the rope from my ankles, then tuck the knife back in my belt. A spotlight skips across the water, searching, as I start swimming to shore. My world is reduced to one stroke after another after another. All of Babel's training in the tank resurfaces. I don't pause to breathe. I am an arrow firing at the eastern bank. A roar announces the boat's approach, but my hands slap down on mud and branches. I gasp out of the water, framed by light, and pull myself onto land. I don't risk looking back. Two stumbling steps bring me through the bank's brush and onto the plain. The spotlight follows. I'm pumping my arms, thinking about all the creatures that hunt at night, when something hits me at hip level. It takes me spinning into the taller grass, and I realize Jericho's caught me. She comes out on top, but my hand is tight on the grip of my knife. I jab upward, and she spins away. My blade grazes her left shoulder. I hear the hiss of pain as she backs off, towering over me, her figure backlit by the boat's light. I try to get to my feet, but she steps forward and strikes again. It forces me onto my back. She circles, strikes, circles. My second attempt at a jab fails. She knocks the knife from my grasp and lands a dirty elbow against my nose. The blow stuns me. Blood gushes. I hack a choking cough as she stands over me.
"You are a worthy opponent. You will take me to the stars."
"Emmett!" The voice has us both squinting back to the river. Jericho's boat has been joined by another. The distant figure doesn't wait for the ship to make land. She leaps from the prow and rolls to her feet. Jericho continues to squint, but it's a voice I would recognize anywhere. Morning. Chapter 22. Duel Through the Dark. Emmett Atwater. Blood runs down my nose. The slightest movement has my vision spinning. I groan my way onto an elbow and watch Morning's approach. Her eyes burn from me to Jericho. The Imago takes a single step, setting herself between us, and Morning's rage doubles. "Give him back," she says, "and I'll let you live." Jericho laughs.
"Do you plan to fight me alone?" "I am Jericho, once of the Seventh Ring. I have killed Savoys, slayed Eradicon. This mace knows its way through bone."
Morning slides out her hatchets and tilts her head. It's a familiar look. She always did it before duels, a moment of weighing her opponent, of finding them wanting.
"Last chance," she says, raising her voice. "Leave now and live."
Jericho laughs again.
"I'll take you too. A second Genesis. More beginnings."
Morning's face steels. There's a second where the wrongness of all this pulses through the air. I don't want Mourning to do what she's about to do. I don't want her to die because of me. Before I can say anything to stop her, she's sliding forward. Her body dips and she closes the gap between them. A false lunge. Jericho lurches. She only gives herself away slightly, but I see Mourning's eyes snap like a camera lens. She sees where Jericho's foot would have stepped and how her mace would have swung. She takes all of that in and slides to the right. I watch her circle before flashing forward. The metal sings. A few exchanged blows is enough to erase the smile from Jericho's face. I wasn't a match for her. But Mourning? She pushes Jericho to the edge of her comfort. It's clear that Mourning is probing the fringes of who Jericho is as a fighter, picking up her habits. After trading a few more strikes, she clears space between them. Jericho is breathing hard. Mourning changes tactics. The Nixian jacket lifts from her shoulders like mist. Jericho narrows her eyes at the manipulation, then smiles. A current cuts through the air. Jericho is wrestling for control of the Nixia. I think about the Imago on the ship, Arone, who took hold of Kaya's necklace. How helpless we were. But in the space of a breath, the sling's expression goes from confident to confused to worried. The Nixia in the air forms four black doors that look like they're made of smoke. One appears in front of Mourning. The other three surround Jericho. She considers Mourning's creation and gives up trying to take control. The grip on her mace tightens. Mourning walks through the first door, and everything distorts. The sound of a whip cracks across the sky, and she appears behind Jericho. Her first blow cuts across Jericho's right calf. The sling cries out, wheeling, but Mourning is faster. A step back and she reappears in the second door. Another lunge brings her hatchet raking across a shoulder. She steps back again. I stare as the doors draw inward, closing around the fight like a noose. Jericho tries to guess where Mourning will appear, but each of her lunges misses. Mourning dips beneath every strike and tags Jericho again and again and again. Each blow draws blood until Jericho is barely on her feet, limping and struggling. Mourning shows no mercy. The Nixian doors close until there aren't any more gaps. They narrow into a perfect cube of black nothing. I hear a final scream before silence thunders out. Mourning? Mourning! The darkness melts away. Mourning comes out one side, disarmed. She's circling. I start to rise, desperate to help her, when I see Jericho. She stumbles to a knee and collapses sideways. Mourning's hatchet is buried in her forehead. She kicks the mace away, and the two of us watch as Jericho takes her last breaths. Mourning's chest heaves chaotically. I can tell it's not the pump of adrenaline. She's taken a life. Blood is on her hands. I start forward to help her, but she holds up a hand in warning. Give me space. I stand there, watching, as she leans over Jericho. She closes the sling's eyes and cleans the bloodied hatchet on the grass. After a second, she transforms her Nixia into a shovel and begins to dig. When I start to manipulate mine, she shoots me a look that's made of iron. No, she says. You heard Speaker. Down here, you bury them yourself. Chapter 23. Across the Universe, Emmett Atwater. The sun decides to rise. Light stretches across the riverway and paints the highest branches gold. I sit there in silence as Mourning buries Jericho, a stranger in a strange land. Only when she sets aside the shovel, sweating and exhausted, do I cross the distance. Mourning doesn't say a word. She lets me wrap my arms around her. I hold on until she stops crying. She rescued me. She saved me. But the cost of this will chain her to this place forever. I file this one away for both of us. I put this one in the place where I've stored the darkest memories, piles upon piles of angry moments. I, for injustice. She didn't deserve this. I can see her steeling herself, pushing the pain down far enough that she doesn't have to feel it. After a second, she looks up, face carved like some beautiful ruin. She pulls me down by the collar and kisses me. I run one hand through her hair. Each following kiss softens until we're a whisper away.
I thought I lost you,
she says. I knew it was you. The second that boat pinged on our radar, I knew it was you. She nods once, eyes trailing the fresh grave. For the first time, she notices the blood coating her sleeves. The sight makes her tremble.
I told her to let you go.
Hey, none of that. Jericho kidnapped me, poisoned me. I have no idea what would have happened if you didn't save me. Fathom? Her jaw tightens, but she doesn't resist. I take her by the hand and lead her back to the river. She stands there like a ghost as I sit her down and help rinse off the stains. She's not the first one to wash blood away in Magnia's rivers. She won't be the last. I grab my knapsack and we get into the boat. Morning sits in the back as I direct us back through the riverway. It's as easy as reversing her route and letting the boat handle the rest. I keep an eye out for creatures, other ships, but it's like we're driving through an abandoned world. I don't push the conversation, so most of the journey rolls by in silence. Near the outskirts of Myriad, she stands up and joins me by the console. After a few seconds, she takes my hand.
You learn to defend yourself, she says. You know?
I nod at that. Like a sixth sense.
I got bullied at school. Bigger girls. I was pretty small for my age, I guess. Started figuring out how to use everything to my advantage. Reading people. Changing the fight. Most days, I really hate that this is what I'm good at. But today, I would go back there and do it all over again. If it meant saving you, I'd go back.
And that makes you a good person. You know that, right? She sighs.
Why are you so nice to me?
I look down at my feet to make sure her words haven't transformed me into something else, into a bird or the wind or something. It's easy with you. Sunlight strays through the branches. It's bright across her light brown skin. She's beautiful the way a mountain is tall. I almost tell her before stopping. You don't need to tell a mountain it's tall. It already knows that. The conversation turns. The river breeze reminds us of what we left behind. We share little pieces of our hearts, our homes. She tells me her favorite dessert. I describe my boys. The words grow wings as we talk our way back across the universe. Chapter 24. Pieces of the Puzzle. Emmett Atwater. The sight of Myriad brings reality's shoulders slamming back into us. Omar waits on the dock, his wide face full of worry. Morning guides the boat in and tosses him the ropes. He sets to the task of tying us up, but it's not hard to see how angry he is.
You should have waited, he rumbles. Why risk going alone?
I ran into Jamie and Longway on the bridge, she answers. I saw the boat leaving with Emmett on it. I made a choice. It worked.
Omar heaves a sigh.
There were other slings in the base, but only Longway's hurt.
I remember the way he stepped in and shoved Jamie out of the way. It might be the most unselfish thing he's done since I first met him. I can't imagine he'll go exploring with us anytime soon. He took a pretty nasty shot on the bridge. Omar helps us both off the boat.
One eye caught most of the damage. He's in the med bay now. Should be fine. And the plans might be changing. Speaker says there's an Imago guard making their way to us now. More security after the attack exposed Babel.
I nod at that.
You never said if you found Corporal West. We found him,
Morning says.
About 3 kilometers from the base. Dead.
We booked it back to Myriad, Omar says. but the attack was already happening, and you had already been taken. Come on. Speaker wants to address the whole crew. Make sure we know what happens next.
The main room is full. Beckway and Valley stand by the entrance like bodyguards. The rest of the Genesis crew sits in grim silence until they see us. They let loose a roar and come surging forward, crowding around to welcome us back.
Always getting in trouble,
Katsu says with an arm wrapped around my shoulders. Jamie crowds in.
I'm sorry, man. I'm still not seeing straight from that shot to the head. I told Morning what happened as soon as she got here. I'm glad you survived.
We bump knuckles. Got lucky, I say. No sweat, man. As the noise settles down, Speaker steps forward and clears his throat.
Emmett, I am glad to see you alive and well. I must apologize on behalf of our entire society for what happened here last night. It's a mark against our hospitality that any of you were in danger.
He pauses meaningfully.
However, there is a clause in the interstellar contract regarding this. Babel gave us the right, in the event that they failed to protect you, to accelerate the timeline of moving you to Sevenset. We need to speak with one of your leaders.
Morning nods over to Parvin.
Let's get Raquin on a call.
It's a surprise to see Parvin sporting the familiar Babel-made glove that we all watched Kit use to control the station. Genesis 12 must have found it when they located West's body. Jazzy stands at Parvin's shoulder, talking through the floating interface. It takes them a few moments to figure it out, but a wall eventually retracts near the entrance to reveal the same kind of screen Kit used in our first conversation with Raquin. Parvin sends off a message before looking back our way.
I have no idea how long it will take, she says.
For all we know, Kit put these requests in days in advance. I don't even know when they'll receive it.
We can wait, Speaker replies. Our guard is coming regardless, but we'll remain inside the base until we can discuss the necessity to move on to Sevenset as soon as possible.
The room takes a breath. Katsu mutters something about needing a mojito, and we all stare when Holly marches straight for the base's makeshift kitchen. Katsu's mouth hangs open.
Wait! He says. I didn't mean you... I don't think we even have ingredients!
He pushes to his feet and heads after her. My eyes flick back to Speaker and the other Imago. I hope they really have a solution for what's happening to her. A second of eyeing Speaker is a reminder of what was so unexpected about Jericho. I nod his way.
My kidnapper was a woman.
My voice carries around the room.
We kind of thought there weren't many women left, based on what you've said. They live in the sanctum, right?
Speaker glances briefly toward the entrance. Bally and Beckway have taken an unconscious step forward, the news cracking across them like a whip. There's a second where they all silently make sure they're on the same page. Speaker takes a deep breath before looking back my way.
Who was she? Did she give you a name?
Jericho.
Speaker lowers his eyes. I realize I've seen this kind of gesture before. Jamie did it, aboard Genesis 11.
I must have dismissed it before, because Speaker's a different species. We were told the cues and the body language would be different. But he's giving himself time to think. It's the thing most people do as they dig down for the right lie to tell.
When he looks up, that renewed confidence sits comfortably in his eyes. He spins gold for us.
A staggering loss, he says. One of a handful of women remaining in our society. It's senseless, really. Jericho could have had whatever she wanted. I've never understood what might motivate someone to become a sling, but for a woman it is even stranger. I did not know her personally. I do remember that she was a warrior of some renown.
He looks over to the other Imago. Beckway steps forward with a nod.
She's from the Seventh Ring, he says. Southside Battalion, a ranked duelist.
Speaker weighs that.
Lucky then that the two of you are alive.
It must have taken all of your considerable skill to bring her down together.
Morning and I exchange a glance. She doesn't mention the fact that she defeated one of their ranked duelists all on her own. I decide to keep my mouth shut about that, too. Speaker says,
"It is a sad day for our people. Her death will be mourned across the rings."
I watch him carefully. He's lying again. I don't call him out on it, because I don't understand. Why would he need to lie about this? It takes a few seconds to remember where we're standing. Myriad is one of Babel's only strongholds on Magnia. Is that why? Is he trying to mislead them? A staticky voice cuts through my thoughts. The screen behind Parvin blinks into existence, Raquin staring out at us.
"Genesis crew," Raquin says in greeting. "We just watched the footage of Corporal West's capture. Have the Atomites offered any explanation?"
Speaker steps forward. I'm watching him more closely now, looking between the lines. Since our introduction, he's been the perfect diplomat. He frames every response with a smile. The sight of Raquin tests his abilities as an actor. I note the narrowed eyes and the pulsing vein at his neck, visible for just a moment before he steps into character.
"An outlying faction," Speaker says. "They exist outside of Seven Set's governance."
"They're still Atomites," Raquin replies. "Will you activate the Arone provision?"
That name thunders through me. Arone. I'm the only Genesis member in the room who knows his name. Marcus Defoe let that detail slip in the discussions after Kaya's death. Arone is the captured imago. What's the provision? What does that mean? Speaker glances back to the entrance. Beckway and Bally nod their encouragement.
"This interpretation stretches the intended purpose of that provision," he says. "But as a sign of good faith, we'll accept the provision and activate our new request. Seven Set."
Raquin mulls that over. I watch as he fakes discomfort. Like Speaker, he's setting up a well-manicured lie.
"That's far too soon. It's 1/3 of the expected timetable."
"And right now you've offered only 1/3 of the expected protection. Holly's mistake occurred because of the inadequate training. Corporal West died, and you are fortunate none of the Genesis suffered the same. Our one core agreement still stands, the one statement present in every clause of the treaty. The children must survive."
My mind races. We mean more to them than we know.
"Very well," Raquin replies. "But under two conditions."
"Give them and we will decide," Speaker replies.
I'd forgotten that Speaker has another side. We've never asked him about the name he gave during his introduction. The Daughter's Sword. Occasionally, the quiet and soft-spoken version vanishes beneath something far fiercer. Right now, he looks just like he did when the sling appeared outside Foundry in search of blood. It's nice to see Raquin meet his match.
"They travel in our trucks," Raquin says. "There are some inherent defenses that would make us more comfortable. Feel free to accent that protection with whatever patrols you think necessary, but it allows us to extend safeguards and ensure their arrival in Seven Set."
I glance over at Morning. She's sifting through the request just like the rest of us. I see her raise one eyebrow, and I know she sees what I see. Using the trucks keeps Babel in the loop. Whether they have cameras on board or just some standard tracking coordinates, it allows them to stay more in the know than any Imago-provided travel would.
"We accept your request," Speaker says. "What's the second condition?"
"Ophelia Station," Raquin says. "I want my teams to personally confirm that Corporal Ava Raheely hasn't been compromised. If she's not there, we have the right to pull half of our team from the planet."
He's bluffing again. They don't want to pull us from the planet. Besides,
They clearly have eyes on all their bases. If what he said about West is true, they're on a delay, but they still have footage. Babel would know within 24 hours if someone was dead or alive in their base. There has to be some other reason for sending us there.
Extending their time outside of Seven Set endangers them, Speaker says simply.
Raquin smiles.
We're not the ones trying to kidnap them. The Slings have attacked twice. During our last discussion, you assured us that they were a limited threat. How can we trust that they won't attack again once you're inside the city?
The odds of a successful attack decrease in Seven Set. As you are well aware, the contract between us demands a minimal Adamite presence while your crews work the mines. This was against our advisement. We wanted contingents of 5 or 6 soldiers with each of your teams. You denied that request. Their security details in the city will be much larger. We will also have control over which routes we take through the city. We will know where they are going and how to defend each location from attack. That measure of control has been lacking in Grimgarden. Seven Set will be a safe option. You have my word.
The room's quiet as Raquin considers the information. After a moment, he shakes his head.
I need confirmation that Ava Raheely is alive and well at Ophelia Station. The crews do not need to stay there for longer than a few minutes. Visit the location, confirm her presence, move on to Seven Set. I suppose we can make up these days after their visit.
Speaker nods.
Agreed. So long as the trucks do not cross the barriers established in the proximity clause, we accept the 2 requests in exchange for an earlier departure date.
We accept 2,
Parvin chimes in.
Not that either party asked our opinion.
Speaker looks a little embarrassed about that. Raquin just smiles.
You'll be the first explorers to ever enter the capital city of an alien race on a distant planet. I didn't expect you of all people to complain, Parvin.
She adjusts her glasses.
Point taken.
On to Seven Set, Raquin says. I'll await word of Corporal Raheely. Godspeed.
The feed is killed. Speaker looks relieved as the group starts moving around the base. Most of the crew looks exhausted. I bump Morning with an elbow.
I want to go see Longway.
You should, she says. I'm going to talk with Speaker. Do some digging.
I lower my voice to a whisper. He was lying about Jericho. I don't know why. Maybe he thinks Babel's listening. If they are, maybe it's better we don't dig right now. And Raquin's lying, too. He wants us in the city just as much as Speak does.
Morning nods. I knew Raquin was lying. Didn't catch Speaker. I'll proceed with caution.
I shoulder my knapsack and we head in opposite directions. I hate to admit how thankful I am for silence. Other members of the Genesis crew are moving through the halls, but it feels like we're all in different orbits, gliding through our own temporary universes. A shiver runs down my spine as I think about the last time I visited the med unit. This time the door is already open. Bright light filters out into the hallway. Longway is lying there with his eyes closed. Omar was right. It's a nasty wound. The blow slashed the spot just above his eyebrow and all the way down to his cheekbone. Instead of sewing him up, someone packed the wound with a liquid form of Nyxia. The substance gleams back like the surface of a black mirror. Longway would have the most badass-looking scar. I glance right and catch my own reflection for the first time in days. There's dried blood under one nostril. I thought I had stubble, but it's almost worked its way into a beard. There's more pops in my face than ever. I've got his wide eyes and full lips. The only difference is that time with Babel has carved a restless look into me. Pops always looks comfortable in the world around him. He has a way of blending into every backdrop. I look more dangerous. Put me back on the streets of Detroit and people would notice.
Emmett?
The voice is all rust. Longway looks up with one eye. The other stays shut, even though I can see the muscles twitching around the wound.
He's alive!
I say, walking over.
I went and got kidnapped. You found the wrong end of a weapon. We really gotta work on staying out of trouble, man.
There's the faintest hint of a smile.
How bad is it?
The wound?
I think you're disqualified from future space travel. Stuck here, man. This time he really does smile.
Do you think I'll see out of this eye again?
I can only shake my head. I wasn't the one who treated it. Maybe Speak did? They patched you up with Nixia. I'll have to ask. I'm sure you're going to be fine. Longway leans back and sighs. And hey, I continue. It's kind of like they made you an honorary Imago. It almost looks like one of those Nixian implants they all have.
Maybe you have superpowers.
He nods once.
I forgot to tell you that I can read minds now.
A snort slips out. Longway telling jokes is very new territory.
Yeah? What am I thinking about?
That's easy,
he says.
You're thinking about mourning.
I laugh at that. You came into your powers awful quick. He smiles again, flicker, and gone. It's quiet for a while. This is new for us. Most of the words we exchanged aboard Genesis 11 were threats. That was what Babel wanted from us. Iron scraping against iron. They wanted us sharp and hard and cold. This conversation feels right, though. Kaya offered comfort. Belial offered kindness. Every time I offer the same, it's a whisper of a promise that I won't forget them, that they're both with me now and forever. I pull a second gurney over and adjust the back into a sitting position. Longway glances over with a frown.
Are you sick?
Nah, not sick. His frown deepens.
Then what are you doing?
Hanging out with you, man.
He swallows once and closes his eyes. It takes a few seconds to pull my player out from the bottom of my knapsack. I scroll through songs before tapping his shoulder and offering one of the earbuds. He stares at it for a few seconds before fitting it into an ear. I play a soft song. It feels like hip-hopping down a river. Longway actually starts to nod his head after the first chorus.
I knew you'd like it, I say.
It's better than the first song.
I frown. The first song?
You played it during our first meeting with Babel. It was so annoying.
I laugh at the memory. Sorry. I turned it up just to grind at you.
No worries, he says, exhaustion in his voice. I still beat you.
You were only up by 200,000 points at the end. I was totally gaining on you. That earns another smile. We sit there, listening, until he falls asleep. Chapter 25. Ophelia Station. Emmett Atwater. For the second time, we stand in front of a Babel stronghold and wait for the Imago to arrive. This time, though, Speaker stands formally at our side. It's a reminder that we've already been accepted and welcomed. In the distance, 12 black dots loom larger. Dirt and dust spin skyward. We watch them unfold like the wings of strange insects. Imago pour out from the linked vehicles in smooth formation. I recognize Thesis from the first meeting. He's smiling his too wide smile like we weren't just attacked by some of his people. All the guards, though, are new faces. Every one of them comes armed. A short gasp leaves Speaker's lips. We watch him bow unexpectedly. Our entire group grows rigid, unsure if we should do the same. The formation of soldiers fans out, and we finally see the reason for Speaker's reaction.
Genesis, Thesis announces. I present one of the daughters of Sevenset.
Thesis takes a knee as the woman strides forward. She walks with all the grace and bearing of a queen. Her dress takes the sunlight and spins patterns out of it. Flowers, abstract shapes, curling leaves. The shapes change and slash with each step forward, dizzying to the eye. Like Jericho, she's taller and slighter than the male Imago. Her wide-set eyes are the same color I saw as I fell from space, the deep and dangerous blue of their world's oceans. A veil of brown hair frames a full face. Babel hadn't seen a female Adamite in decades, according to their reports. I've seen two in less than 24 hours. Theseus gestures to her.
This is Ashling, known as the Beckoning Star, the Bright Reach.
Ashling's smile is brief and stunning.
Welcome to Magnia. On behalf of the daughters, I invite you to Sevenset. Our home is open. Our people await. Will you come?
Parvin steps forward as our spokesperson.
Of course. Thank you.
The daughter's smile brightens to blinding. She's just as excited to meet us as the other Imago were, but she wears it regally.
You are a gift our people will cherish for generations. I understand that one of your number has been gripped. Will she come forward?
Before we can answer, Holly strides out, unable to resist the beckoning of a queen.
She will come with me,
Ashling says, and it is not a question. It's a statement that becomes reality.
I will watch over her with my own life. Arrangements are being made to treat her. The process will depend on her instincts and toughness. If it is in our power to guide her back, the next time you see your friend, she will be as you knew her.
A whispered word from Ashling has Holly marching toward the Nixian carriers. Ashling eyes us for another moment, nods once in expectation, and turns. Two guards follow, protecting her flank. No one says a word as Nixia swallows them, as the vehicles become dark streaks along the distant hills. My heart beats hopefully. I have to believe Holly is tough enough to survive. Theseus steps forward in Ashling's place, with all the dramatic flair of an actor.
If we want to start the entrance ceremony before nightfall, we should begin the journey. I believe you're providing your own transportation?
Parvin uses Corporal West's glove to bring the trucks out of their loading bays. She's savvy enough with the tech to preset our coordinates for Ophelia Station. She tucks the glove into her knapsack when she's done. Morning gives her a look and she shrugs.
You never know. Might be useful.
I start to follow Morning into the nearest truck, but Omar cuts me off and climbs up behind her. I raise an eyebrow and follow. We take our seats in the cab, and Morning actually groans when she realizes that he's planted himself between us.
Now this is a proper date, he says, smiling.
Longway's helped into the truck in front of us. Jamie and Azima sit with him in the back of the truck bed. He actually waves at me. I grin and wave back like a little kid. It's like we've summoned some new version of Longway into being, and I don't want to lose him. Azima throws an arm around him. She whispers some joke and they laugh together. Morning leans far enough forward that she can get a good look at me.
We're family now, aren't we?
She asks. Didn't start that way, but yeah, those are my brothers and sisters up there.
Katsu's more of a cousin, though.
Don't forget, Omar rumbles. We have two more sisters waiting in Sevenset.
And a brother,
Morning corrects, just in case Babel is listening.
I haven't forgotten them. Let's just hope the Imago have helped all three come to their senses.
The drive begins quietly. The rumble of engines drowns out conversation. The hills of Grimgarden roll past. Black spheres ride in protective formations along both flanks. If the slings make another appearance, we'll meet them with force this time. I try to glance over at Morning, but Omar's broad shoulders are in the way. He shoots me a lopsided grin.
If you want to write her a note, he suggests, I could review it before passing it on.
I shake my head. Back on Earth, Omar's not allowed on any dates. Morning laughs.
Dates? You asking me out?
There's this restaurant in Detroit. It's where my parents went on their first date. Burgers as big as your head. I thought we could go there. And if that goes well,
I could take you over to the Riverwalk.
Omar nods. Sounds wonderful. Just send me a date and time.
Morning leans past him. She's clutching her dark braid, cheeks blushing.
Are you asking me out or asking me out?
I smile.
Both.
You want to go with me?
For burgers?
No, like, go with me. Dating for real. Boyfriend and girlfriend.
She deadpans.
You're seriously asking this with him right here?
We're on an alien planet. You saved my life, and this is what bothers you?
She snorts at that, sitting back. After a few seconds, I notice Omar elbowing her.
Well?
He whispers.
You can't just leave him hanging.
Whatever, she says, and I can hear the smile.
Fine. I'll go with you.
The truck continues to thunder over the hills. I feel like I just launched into space again. Omar sits there looking pleased with himself.
This is nice, isn't it?
I roll my eyes at Omar, but there's no way I could be mad now. It's like morning's smile is the only thing that exists in the world. It takes another hour to arrive at Ophelia Station. The building looms, identical to Foundry. We see the matching silo, the paneled tower reaching skyward. They've arranged the greenhouses differently, but otherwise it looks the same. One noticeable change is the figure waiting by the front gates, Corporal Ava Raheely. She flags us down as we approach. I remember that Raquin's reasons for sending us here didn't even come close to lining up. I'm hoping our exchange with Raheely will shed some light on Babel's real intentions. Raheely sports the same glove that Kit did. As the trucks pull in across from her, she raises the digital interface and makes some adjustments. I glance around the base, looking for a response from the solar windows or the greenhouse roofs, but nothing happens. She backhands the screen away and sweeps her other hand through dark hair. Matching eyeshadow gives her a thoughtful, brooding look. She's not quite as young as Kit, but I doubt she's clear of 25. It's only when we've climbed down from the trucks and started walking her way that I realize how short she is. Barely up to my shoulders. She might not be tall, but she's still plenty intimidating.
You're here early, she says.
The veins of her robotic glove hold their blue glow, like she's ready to summon the base's systems into action at a moment's notice. She doesn't have the same automatic trust that Kit did when we first arrived. Parvin takes the lead, and Speaker and the other Imago remain safely in the background.
We were redirected by Raquin, Parvin explains. We came here to make sure you were still alive. After checking in with you, we're supposed to head directly to Seven Set.
Raheely nods along like this is all news to her.
What happened to West?
He's dead, Parvin answers. The slings came for him. You haven't had any visitors?
Nothing I couldn't handle,
Raheely replies smoothly.
What about the trucks? Are you taking them all the way to the gates of the city?
I hear a distant ping cut through the air. It's the same sound you hear when a program finishes downloading. Raheely ignores it, but I notice the palm of her glove flashing like she's got a new notification or something. I file it under S for suspicious as hell.
We're leaving them a specific distance away, Parvin answers. Speaker mentioned there's a rule in place because of the treaty, a line we're not allowed to cross.
The proximity clause,
Raheely confirms.
Here, I'll program the truck to return to Ophelia so I can outfit them and send them back to Myriad. As you can see, I'm alive and well. Feel free to move on after I program the return sequence.
Parvin nods before taking a polite step back. Raheely brings up the interface again. Morning gives the all clear, and our crews disperse back to their trucks. I follow the order, but my eyes trail back to Raheely. She took the news of West's death easily. Maybe she's tough. Or maybe she already knew. The consoles inside the truck show loading symbols in the top right corner. Raheely's instructions walk our systems through their new directives. We sit there waiting until the screen finishes the upload. Morning waves down to her when it's done.
You're all set, Raheeli calls up.
Fire away.
And just like that, we're leaving Ophelia Station behind. The trucks angle away from the base, heading northeast. I crane my neck to get a look back, but Raheeli's already vanished inside the tower. I keep my suspicions locked away for now. I'll talk to Morning when we're not sitting inside a Babel-made truck. I'm not sure what just happened, or why the exchange with Raheeli felt so wrong. I just get the feeling that Babel's plans are spinning all around us like invisible webs. I can still see the faces of all the frozen marines they have buried in their hidden basements. Genesis. Not just the name the Imago chose for us. Babel calls us that too. I realize we're heading for a city that Babel, in spite of all their power and intelligence, has never entered. It's been over 2 decades, and they've been cut off at every pass by a superior species. Jericho's not the only one who views us as a new way through the dark. Babel does too. Genesis. As we walk through the city's gates, is Babel walking through them with us? Chapter 26. A Taste of History. Emmett Atwater. The outer wall of Sevenset looms darkly against the horizon. Above it, a span of blue brushstrokes. Below it, blinding green fields that look so fake, I have to reach down and run my fingers through the blades of grass just to make sure I'm not dreaming. The wall is a study of black. Midnight spires stagger up every 300 meters, narrowing to spikes the color of pitch. The walls look charred, like dragons have breathed fire against them for centuries. A towering 5-story gate sits at the very center of the construction. There's a full hour between the first time we see the distant gates and the moment we stand before an older outer gate. We leave the trucks behind. It's like throwing a huge weight off our shoulders. Babel's grasp on us is about to loosen. The Imago escorts lead us to the smaller wall, one that could only be called a ruin. Stones have fallen from their keeps. Weather has worn down the structure for what looks like centuries. They walk us to a fragmented archway. It's thicker than I expected, and the space beneath the arch has been carved out with purpose. Theseus asks us to take seats around a pit that's been dug in the ground. We can see the actual gates looming just a football field away.
A traditional entrance ceremony, Theseus announces, his voice taking on a dramatic weight. Every true Imago partakes in this ceremony. It's a taste of our history.
A mouse-quiet guard named Journey moves through our ranks. There's something odd about him that I can't quite peg. He doesn't really lock eyes with us or acknowledge our thanks. He does get a fire going in no time, though. The sun starts its descent as the flames get bolder, brighter. We watch as Journey places a triangular table over the pit and sets 20 matching alabaster cups on its flattened surface. He removes a bottle that's full of the purest, most silver-looking liquid I've ever seen, and pours a measure into each cup before stepping back and letting the fire heat them from below.
Stray light, Theseus names it. A way to look back.
Smoke curls out from each cup. It's so quiet that I can hear the substance start to boil. Theseus uses a hand-length tool to snatch one from the tray. He sets it on the ground in front of Morning, then moves on to the next person, and the next. He instructs us not to drink until the liquid stops churning. He raises his own cup when the time is right.
To old ways and new.
Our escorts and the guards echo the phrase. We all repeat the words and take our first tentative sips. Noor almost chokes. It takes a few slaps on the back from Parvin to set her straight. The liquid curls around my tongue. It's heavy, like warmed honey, but it skips from one taste to the next as it goes down. It's like my tongue is chasing flavors it can't quite catch.
When you finish, Theseus says, watch the city walls.
He gestures to the distant gate. We all sit there, waiting patiently, unsure what we're supposed to see. Jazzy's the first one to let out a gasp of surprise. The noise echoes through our group.
I realize that whatever the effect is, it's hitting the lighter and smaller of us first. I'm starting to wonder if Straylight is a type of alcoholic beverage when I finally see it. The distant wall has vanished. The plain appears empty, just a set of cliffs that overlook a brooding ocean. It's not possible. As I watch, the plain fills with people. They're burdened, stumbling on in a huge group, setting themselves down wearily. Theseus begins his narration.
After the March of Folly, our ancestors came here. The population had suffered a massive blow. The people, you see, were determined to live. It became the dominant characteristic of our kind. Come rain or fire, come plague or famine, we survive.
Time speeds forward. We watch buildings rise up, burn back down, and rise again. Enemies attack the edges of the makeshift village, but the survivors turn them back. The houses bloom larger. Outer walls spin into existence. We watch centuries pass by in minutes.
A village became a town. A town became a city. A city cast itself over the water.
My attention is drawn to the harbor. Boats roam the shore as another wall flings itself skyward. Taller this time, meant to separate the land from the sea. We can see the village in front of us shrink as the wall grows.
As various primes evolved into our natural predators, we created the first barrier. The outer ring of Sevenset began here. A queen named Marimar directed us to build out into the ocean using Nyxia. She oversaw the creation of the sixth ring. Her granddaughter led the construction of the fifth, and then the fourth.
My entire body becomes weightless. I feel like I'm flying. Something pulls me forward by the chest, and my vision struggles to take it all in. I hold my breath as momentum carries me right through the outer wall of Sevenset. Out over the first fledgling ring, now known as the Seventh. Theseus's words carry us over massive stretches of ocean, to the next ring, and the next, until finally,
the Sanctum.
Our bird's eye view shows an island dominated by a single, sprawling building. It stretches over everything like the roots of a tree. One side is dominated by a vast glass window. The other shows off countless spires, all scraping their way to the clouds.
Home of the current daughters, Theseus explains. Our queens. But all of this began here. As you walk each ring, as you become the first human group to grace our city, know now what went into its making. Know how our history shaped this impossible place. Know that we did whatever it took to survive a cruel and difficult world. Know, this is our home.
I flinch back as the images reverse. We fly from the sanctum, crossing oceans, skipping rings, until we're sitting around the fire again. The sunlight is fading. The vision vanishes. Theseus stands solemnly before us. He holds out his hands like he's just completed a performance on a stage. I glance to my right and realize Speaker is weeping. Many of the guards are, too. They don't wipe the tears away. Maybe among their kind, it's not something worthy of shame. Theseus allows us to feel the full weight of his words before smiling.
It's also a tradition to celebrate. Pour our friends more drinks, Journey.
The transformation happens in 5 minutes flat. The rest of the Imago are curious and excited to be with us. Their enthusiasm is infectious. Speaker leads the cooking. He spits and roasts two animals I've never seen before. We mingle with the honorary escorts as he does. Journey's talent for beverages has our cups filled with a drink we're told will have us dancing in no time. I stand with Speaker for a while, trying to understand the story Theseus just told us. So, the daughters, they live in the sanctum? Speaker nods.
At the very center of Sevenset.
Why didn't Babel know about them? I don't remember learning about the daughters from any of Babel's studies.
We never allowed Babel to meet them, he says. Your employers knew about the last child born on Magnia.